I'm here with Alan Richardson with the CM Press project. It's Thursday the 15th of September and we are going to talk about the CM Press oil spill in 1996. So if you could just tell me about yourself now and maybe what you were doing at the time.
I'm an international mountain guide, photographer and writer, and an outdoor instructor. I've lived in Pembrokeshire for 20 years of my life, and it's quite, ironic's the wrong word, but it's quite strange really that I actually had moved to Pembroke almost the week that the CM Press disaster happened to forge a life with my wife at the time as an instructor and mountain guide in using Pembrokeshire as my base. I travel all over the world. I work a lot with local centres, outdoor centres, training their staff. And of course, rock climbing was a really important part of my life and was the major reason that I moved to Pembrokeshire. I've been climbing all of my life and Pembrokeshire's one of the top rock climbing venues, sea cliff climbing venues in the world. It's people don't realise how important it is to rock climbers. It is world famous, and climbers come from all over the world to tackle some of the challenging routes that Pembrokeshire has to offer, and that's why I moved here. It's one of the few places where within 5 minutes of the car park you can be having a complete adventure without huge walk-ins, and for me, being away as a mountain guide all over the world, then to come back home, I couldn't really disappear for days to go rock climbing for myself. I had a family to look after and bring up. So disappearing for a couple of hours and having an adventure was a great asset, which is why I moved to Pembrokeshire.
You said that you'd been here a week.
Yeah, well, I've been coming to Pembroke for years. So when my wife was offered a job in the National Health Service in Pembrokeshire, we actually given a choice between North Wales on the Clun Peninsula or Pembrokeshire. And we chose Pembrokeshire because I'd fallen in love with it over the years climbing. I used to live in Cardiff, so in Swansea. So coming down here, rock climbing, I had a great affection for the place anyway and a lot of good memories. And then we moved down and we were actually living in Manabira in a rented accommodation there. And I can still vividly remember being in tears coming down that week. We'd settled in, we'd just got ourselves settled into the house, and I got up early in the morning, walked down to walking down to the beach to see the beautiful coastline, and just being in a state of shock. I hadn't heard anything about the disaster at that point, or whether it actually got out, I don't know. But we were on Manabir Beach, and all I can remember, my first memory was the sound. Not the smell, actually. The smell came on pretty quick afterwards. It was just the sound. There was a gloop, 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 gloop sound of the water instead of a sort of a splashing sound. And it was, I was just gobsmacked. I mean, it still makes me feel a little bit emotional now. And I just remember looking at this blackness and on the rocks and on the seashore, and then I could smell it. But there's a selfish side to this that I was just thought, oh my God, we're screwed. Mm. I'd come here to be an instructor and to teach climbing and to be a climber. I just thought, that's it. It's all over for me.
So the time, did you had a job?
No, I was freelance. I was fairly well known, so I had clients, I had work. I was going to work at local outdoor centres at the time. I was just freelancing. I was self-employed. And I spent a lot of time away. I was an international mountain guide, so a lot of my work was taking me away, which wasn't the problem. But it meant that when I came back home, my work locally had disappeared. Well, that's what I felt at the time. It was just I thought, I can't work. Yeah, it was. Yeah, and it did. I can't remember whether I actually cried in that moment, but sometime, I did. I just thought, this is what a mess. I've just moved to Pembrokeshire, We're hoping to make a new life here. And I did think this is ruined for decades, not a short, relatively short period of time, which is what it was in reality. So at that time, yeah, it was a nightmare. Yeah.
So what happened next then?
Well, it's 20 years ago, so I mean, I've been thinking since I first met you and trying to put together the sort of stages of things that I remembered. So it's a little bit hazy in terms of what actually happened. I remember walking back home to my family and saying, "Oh my God, have you seen what's happened?" And then, you know, the radio was on or the TV or wherever it was. We started picking up bits and pieces. We didn't have internet in the place we were in at the time. I don't even know, 20 years ago, whether internet would have been picking that sort of stuff up. I'm not sure. And it was just, we went down then or the next day, just went down. I went down with the kids, and it was just like, oh my God, this is terrible. I just thought the oil on the rocks wouldn't be able to climb because my gear would get damaged. I wondered how far up it had gone up the cliffs, because the tidal range in Pembrokeshire is huge, you know, especially on spring tides, which was happening at the Sea Empress disaster. The oil would have gone a long way up the cliff. The only saving grace was, I guess, that it didn't happen it happened in February, so there was probably some time before the high season of rock climbing and other tourism as well. I'm specifically looking at rock climbing, but it would have affected kayaking or lots of outdoor pursuits. I do remember thinking then that, and I was talking to a lot of outdoor centres, that there was a compensation scheme for those people who could show that their work had been, where their equipment had been damaged or they'd lost revenue because of it. I think, I'm not 100% sure of that.
I think that is the case. Yeah.
And I remember looking at that and wondering whether I could apply for it. But you know, as a freelance person whose work comes in probably in Pembrokeshire, comes in no more than 4, 5, 6 weeks ahead, it's very hard for me to prove that, you know, I had clients there waiting. You know, people normally phone me up a week before, or I'd get work in outdoor centres maybe a month in advance. The organised outdoor centres would have been in a much better position to get compensation for the loss of work. I mean, I can't put a figure on it, but I certainly lost in that first year a lot of work where people didn't come down.
So, and you didn't
at least claim. 30 days. I had no way of claiming really, because I didn't have bookings in that way. I usually had clients who would phone me up and say, "I'm coming to Pembroke next week with the family. Are you around 2 days to take me climbing?" Or an outdoor centre would phone me up and say, "We need an instructor for a week, can you come in?" So I don't know what work I would have lost, but I mean, an estimate would have been 30 to 60 days I would have lost work that year.
Yeah.
And of course, I'd just moved to Pembrokeshire, so although I'd been working in Pembrokeshire, travelling down, moving to Pembrokeshire to live and work, you know. But luckily I had work abroad, so I just, you know, lived on that. My wife was working as well, so I just spent more time with the kids, really. So it wasn't such a bad deal for me, but I can imagine that somebody who relied on their earnings as the major source of income, it would have been a complete disaster. I was lucky in that sense that it wasn't, and I was able to go and work away. My only regret really is I didn't take any photographs. Now it's ironic, now me being a photographer as well, that a professional photographer, I sell my images, is that I didn't take any photographs at the time. It wasn't, I don't know why that was. I've got one photo. I look, after talking to you, I looked through my photography and I can't find anything that relates to it at all. And after that, I remember, and I was trying to remember, because I said to you, that I went and did some clean up work, And I certainly, I was trying to remember exactly where these places were. Now, climbers were involved in a few places, because the conservation bodies and the cleanup people couldn't really get into some of the difficult places like Huntsman's Leap or Stennis Fjord. They couldn't assess the damage, and it was those zones where the storms don't really ever get into, where there were, you know, big collections of oil, because the storms would smash it up off the rocks and the very exposed rocks and take it away in the backs of cracks for ages. I remember putting my hand in and going, oh god, there's, you know, some oil in the back of a crack or something. But after the sea can be pretty violent in Pembrokeshire, and that cleaned the cliffs a lot quicker than I would have thought. I can't put a time scale on it. I can't remember whether it was, you know, 3 months, 6 months, 12 months. All I remember is that being surprised how quickly the oil came off the cliffs, because it was 20 foot up. You know, you couldn't not do some of the rock climbs for a substantial period of time.
So when did you sort of first go back on the rocks to climb? Right.
So the question you just asked was, when did we actually start climbing again? There were areas that were well above the sea level. There are some climbing areas in Pembrokeshire that are well above the sea level. So we were able to go climbing, you know, pretty much straight away. There are some areas that are, you know, the climb start 30 feet up the cliff anyway, so there wasn't going to be much oil at that level. So there were areas we could go climbing in, but the major top areas, the St. Govan's areas, Stackpole, Mowing Word, and anything that was down at sea level were pretty badly affected. And the zones like Huntsman's Leap and Stackpole were particularly affected, because the storms couldn't get in there to wash the oil out. So I remember that climbers were asked to go into Huntsman's Leap and look. And if I remember correctly, I remember a big crane lifting the boulders out of Huntsman's Leap, and climbers wiped them all down with rocks, and we put them back into the zone again. Now that I was been thinking about this for a while.
Wow.
Now it might be, well, climbers have actually been involved in Pembrokeshire with some cleanup operations quite a few times. I remember cleaning out Huntsman's Leap when a container load of washing machines broke, and we all went down and helped to haul out the mess out of Huntsman's Leap. There were probably 50, 60 washing machines in there, bought various parts for them. And I do remember, and you'd have to ask the people who organised the cleanup operation, whether I'm pretty sure that we had a crane there pulling the boulders out, and we literally wiped boulders clean with rags. We had tons and tons, rolls and rolls of that sort of rag, like a tube rag, and just wipe things down, and then you just put it into a bag and pull them out. And some of the boulders were able to wipe down, and some of the bigger ones, I'm pretty certain we pulled them out on the crane, and they were either pressure washed or whatever happened to them. I can't remember, but it was pretty serious, the cleanup operation in there. But of course, the rest of the cliffs, which can be exposed to the storms, just slowly, or not so slowly actually, the storms smashed, because there was pretty heavy seas afterwards, smashed a lot of the stuff off. But for a very long period afterwards, and I remember losing climbing ropes because of the oil on them, having some of my slings, rock climbing slings, got contaminated and losing those. I remember getting oil on my rock shoes, rock climbing shoes, quite a few times, because stuff would go into the back of cracks and holes and things like that, and that's where the problems were. And of course, when you go climbing, you just put your ropes down on the floor, and you know, the oil had gone underneath a boulder, so whilst it looked superficially clean, as you kicked the boulder, some the sticky, tarry oil would get onto your equipment. So quite quite a long time, and again, I can't put a time scale on it. Certainly, you know, 12, 18 months, we were, you know, having oil on our equipment.
And you're not aware of any sort of accidents or anything that happened as a result?
No, I don't think so. I don't think there was anything that was good. I don't think it was a situation like that. I think that it was more of just an inconvenience, a huge inconvenience to us in terms of wanting to pursue our climbing. And, you know, every climber that I've ever met comes to Pembrokeshire for a number of reasons. They come here for the adventurous climbing. They also come here because it's a stunningly beautiful place, and come here because of the wildlife. There is a degree of friction between the conservation bodies and climbers, but it's only a small degree. Climbers keep to the bird bands. They want to see birds. They don't want to disturb them, or they want to disturb them as little as they possibly can. And so Pembroke seemed like a dead place for a while. It was dead because climbers weren't coming, but it was dead because just birds and that just weren't there. And I was so used to going climbing in Mother Carey's kitchen, for instance, and seeing the kittiwakes, you know, with their stiff wings soaring around the thing, and they weren't there. They just weren't there.
It must have been eerie. Yeah.
It was lucky. I suppose it was lucky, and I'm not a bird expert, but I suppose it was quite lucky that it happened early in the season. The birds, before some of the birds had started returning. So hopefully, you know, and also they nested higher up, but of course their feeding grounds and that, God knows what it would have happened to that. And you know, cormorants and things like that, just didn't see them, you know, for a while, because I understand they were badly affected, and I think there was a colony on called the island, which because we were living, you know, in Manabir, that lots of them nested on there, and I think they were gone. So we did start climbing, and I did manage to find ways of fitting in climbing and fitting in some work around the areas that were badly affected. But the big problem was that the people from outside didn't know that climbing was still available, they didn't know how bad it was, so they just didn't come. They just didn't come for a long time. As I say, the main thing was the storms that came afterwards. There was a problem. First of all, there was a very high tide, which put the oil very high up on the beach, and then after that, the tides were getting lower and lower, so the tide couldn't really wash the stuff off the high areas of the beach, and the high water marks on the cliffs where it got to. But luckily, the big storms did, the big waves, which can come 50 feet over the top of the cliffs in Pembrokeshire. I've seen waves come right over the top of the cliffs in big storms. Would have smashed it up and got rid of it all. But those isolated little bays where the big waves don't get into, then I can imagine that's an issue. And the other thing I remember is it did disappear pretty quickly. And again, there's a couple of times gone on that, 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, I'm not sure. But there was a point where I went, oh, this isn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. But I do remember walking on the beach, and I don't know if they're still there, maybe you can answer this, is that after a certain sea state, whether it was a big storm or constant calm sea, it would reveal big tar pitch like areas under the sand. So we'd be walking into climbs in there aren't that many climbs that are off sandy beaches, but you'd be walking on sandy beaches or down low where there's a little bit of sand, and you suddenly be walking on something where it went hard, and you suddenly realize you were on top of pitch. It was like a pitch. Now that had been buried in the sand. And
so did they bury it? How did?
Well, I think they did. I seem to remember again, and it, as I said, it is a bit hazy, but I seem to remember them digging pits on in Manabir particularly, and this oil being put into this. They sort of shoveled it, and I can't remember whether they made as a collecting place for the, yeah, I'm not sure, but that, yeah, they did dig pits. Now whether that was just so they could then retrieve it and take it away, or whether they were trying to bury it, I don't know, but I don't think where I remember walking on top of this pitch was anywhere where they dug holes. I think it was just that the sea state had dropped it all there. It had gone all tarry, and then I can't remember. I can't remember. There was something about the oil that it was carrying that was made it more difficult. But I can't remember.
I think it was
that.
A lighter oil.
Okay. Right, I can't remember, I just remember something about that. And then I remember that they wanted to take it out to sea and they wouldn't allow it to be taken out to sea. And I can remember all the discussions vividly for the week after it happened, going, what are they doing?
Mm.
And sort of laughing at this idea that you know, the oil was owned by one company, the boat was owned by somebody else, the crew were employed by somebody else, that the captain was employed by somebody else, that he couldn't speak the language. I did feel sorry for the pilot who was you know, responsible originally for it going onto the rocks. I can't remember who it was, but I just remember somebody blaming it initially on him. There's always somewhere there's going to be a reason why it happened. But the support after, we all make mistakes, and I remember thinking, oh my God, I hope he doesn't have to move away from Pembrokeshire. But yeah, I did feel for him, you know, because you know, we all make mistakes, but the support he had before and after was appalling. He'd made a mistake, and the disaster could have been reduced considerably if some very, I certainly hope that lessons have been learned. I know that there were things, radar wasn't working. I remember they used to have to leave the boats outside waiting till the tide was right and then bring them in, and the pilot got it wrong in what way, I don't know. But the impact could have been reduced. They're not being a tug big enough to pull it off the water. That was, I mean, there was something about, I remember one of the, whether it was Mr. Crump or one of the other people that did some work at the National Park for a while, the safety officer, was that there was a population of starfish and things like this that had disappeared, a very rare starfish. And I wonder whether that's come back, and some of these rarer pockets of rarer, very fragile ecosystem or animals that lived in the ecosystem,
well,
very fragile ones.
When we had our walk and talk, we actually saw some examples of the starfish.
Oh, right, okay.
And I think what happened, Robin found, I think he found five of the rare species.
Oh, that's good. That's good news, yeah.
Because he was totally devastated.
Yeah,
he again thought that's it, that's my career over.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How are we going to recover from this? But in actual fact, it created a whole body of research. So without the Sea Empress disaster, they would never have discovered. It was like a whole ecological laboratory. So it was he's done loads and loads of lectures and teaching, and it's still an ongoing thing.
Well, hopefully, I mean, disasters are always going to happen, and you know, we need oil for all sorts of reasons, we have to bring it into a safe port, and Milford Haven is a very safe port generally. But things are always going to happen, and I hope that from the studies that were done by a whole tranche of people in Pembrokeshire, I hope that they do help to make future disasters less bad.
Mm.
You know, that they have got strategies and tactics that they can now use to help it. And whether they spray again or don't spray again, those studies looking at comparing those areas, hopefully will come up with new ideas in the future.
I think, yeah, there's been because it was nobody really knew how to tackle it, and it was the first of its type, especially in our country. So I think a lot of things, a load of lessons have been learned, and lots of studies and research and research papers have been written about it, and people, and they're still teaching, using it as an example. So it's
that's good news. I mean, I remember there were arguments as well about how to clean the birds, and some argument, and again, this is really hazy, some arguments about some machine that they wanted to bring in to wash the birds, and stuffing charcoal down their mouths to try and mop up the stuff, and all sorts of tactics that people were saying, oh well, you know, you shouldn't do that, it's going to kill more than it's going to help, and so on. I hope that out of this terrible disaster, that something good has come out of it, so we know how better to treat. But it's going to happen again.
Mm.
Hopefully it'll never ever happen on the scale
I know,
that
you
we
do
had.
Think,
but the one thing that's very unique about Britain as well is that we do have, especially on its west coast, an incredible coastline. If you think that America, the whole of the coastline of the United States of America, has 10 kilometres of steep sea cliffs, and it's that steepness of the sea cliffs and the high tidal range that cause a lot of the problems from the adventure activity side of things. Around the States, they don't have the cliffs that we have. You know, we have more in Pembrokeshire than they have in the total seaboard of the United States, east and west.
Wow.
which is a phenomenal statistic, really, and that's why climbing is so sea cliff climbing is so important in Britain. And you know, with places like Gogarth in North Wales on Anglesey, and Cornwall, some of the sea cliff climbing down there, and the sea cliff climbing in Pembrokeshire, and of course on the sea cliffs in Scotland, but not so many concentrated areas in Scotland. But those three areas are just world famous. They really, really are world famous. And because as I said earlier, you know, we have climbers coming from all over the world just to taste the sea cliff climbing, because it is unique. It is a very unique experience, and a very beautiful place to be as well.
I think for me, what's been amazing about this project is that I'm from here. I was born here, moved away, and in fact I was living away when it happened, and that's why I don't really have a big recollection of it.
Mm.
But it's really reawakened my respect for where I live, actually, listening to all these different stories, because it's the same old thing. When it's on your doorstep, you don't realise what's out there, and it's just made me see the bigger picture of how incredibly important our coastline is for many different reasons, and what a beautiful and the fact it's a centre of research angle, or it's quite unique, isn't it?
Oh, it is, and I'm still amazed, apart from honeypot areas like the lily ponds and places like that, that even in the busiest tourist season, you can go and find very easily areas in Pembrokeshire where there are very few people walking the coastline.
Yeah.
I'm still amazed how few people locally know their coastline. I know it very, very intimately from being a rock climber, a sea kayaker, being interested in animal life and conservation as well, that I know it very intimately. I'm still finding places that surprise me, where I go, ooh, never seen that before. I've never been down that little track or that little avenue. Only last week I was walking with my daughter, and we were walking just down from my house, and I always take a higher track around coming towards the Manabu, the missile firing bases. And we decided this time to take a slightly lower track before you go up. And as we walked along the lower track, I saw some steps going down. And I've been down this. We went down the steps to a little tiny bay, not a bay that would be any good for swimming from. I think the steps seem to be for fishermen or whatever. They were plastic steps, so they'd been built by the national park or whatever. And there was yet again another little cove, a little bay that I hadn't come across. And
this
was just
local,
yeah. And it happens all the time, either slightly inland, finding trails inland or along the coast. It was after meeting you, I did think for quite a while, and I remember going out and sitting and looking at the cliffs, and some of those things did come flooding back in that first week, where it was just, I just can't believe this.
So there's no regrets about coming to Pembrokeshire?
Oh, not at all, not at all. I mean, it's... Not even
an oil disaster.
No. I mean, I spend a lot of my time of life away from Pembrokeshire. Mm. I really enjoy coming back here. The winters are a bit difficult when the seas are big and whatever. And it's very windy at times. But no, on days like this, I can't think of living anywhere else, really. It's, just the joy of having the beach 10-minute walk away from me and the coast and the cliffs. I go for a run or go and take some photographs. In a way, I'm looking forward to where I can spend whole years here rather than just 5 or 6 months of my life, because I'm away a lot. Yeah. I mean, it's not something that's in the forefront of my mind, but after meeting you and talking to you in the community hall, is it in Manabir? I did. It has come back to me quite a few times, but it's not something that's in the forefront of my brain. It's been really interesting thinking back, and as I say, the two things that instantly came back to me was the noise and the smell. The sound of the sea going gloop gloop and the smell, and that disappeared within 3-4 weeks, if my memory's correct. Yeah, I suppose I didn't spend enough time doing it. I mean, I wasn't one of the major people who were there day after day cleaning up. I wasn't there. I did some sporadic bits and pieces which climbers were involved with, and Manabir. I went down and helped at Manabir with. Put my wellies on and went down, but I don't ever remember putting on a yellow suit like a lot of them had on and being one of the main active cleaner uppers. But I certainly helped and did a little bit and got into some difficult areas to help with the clean up in the difficult areas as climbers were needed. But I was amazed that I was amazed at the number of people who did come forward and help to clean up, and it would be a shame if that volunteering was stopped because of some concern over health and safety. That really, really would. I think that if ever it happened again, the volunteers who would come forward should be allowed to take the risk and themselves on themselves and getting help to take it away.
Oh, just think of all those insurance claims.
I mean, if you consent to it and you know the risks, then
I know.
Yeah, I know the world's changed, and let's not open that that Pandora's box of things. It's I would hope that volunteers would be allowed. I mean, I remember we went in to get the there are a picture somewhere, actually. I did find a picture, not of the oil disaster, but of climbers helping to get the washing machines out if we of Huntsman's Deep, if we'd had to, fill all the health and safety stuff in, we just went in as climbers and tied it all to ropes and pulled it. I think, I can't remember again whether we pulled it out. There was a crane or something there, pulling these bags of rubbish out of there. I mean, oh God, I hope the volunteering is not,
I know,
not, going to be taken that way. But it is, I agree. But it's not
a completely different story, wouldn't it, really? But let's just hope it never happens.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you. That's brilliant.
That's all right. It's been nice reminiscing about it in a strange way, really.